Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Time for Microbrew, Milwaukee Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. The season is over. The Milwaukee Brewers do not make the 2022 playoffs. You knew this by now. They won 2 of 3 against the Diamondbacks to close down the year. But Monday, even after a walk-off win, a tremendous win under normal circumstances, rallying for 3 runs in the ninth and winning in extras, the Brewers were officially eliminated when the Phillies beat the Astros. The Brewers almost finished tied in the standings, but had their own bullpen meltdown. One more for the road in the final game of the season. Gave up a couple runs in the ninth and wound up losing that last game. Fortunately, the emotion was sucked out of it for Brewers fans by that point, but still, that storyline of bullpen struggles definitely showed itself in the second half of the season. On the other line is Kurt Hoag, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's time we do our official look back at the season and look ahead a little bit to 2023. A lot of interesting storylines to follow. This team should be, I think, pretty different, especially when you compare the 22-23 jump versus the last one we saw from 21-22, where a lot of the same players came back. But Kurt, we'll start. Normally when I do our three up, three down segment, it is designed to look at the more granular details from the week, a good play, a good quote, things like that. Let's invert it a little bit. Let's start with three up, three down, and we'll go with the bigger things, the things that we really will either remember 2022 by, or the things that we think truly sort of epitomized why it didn't go as well as we wanted, why a 95-win team came back with a lot of the same players and simply weren't able to top that. They won 86 games, and that was well short of their goal, I'm sure, and certainly a game, a full game, basically two, but a full game in the standings, short of a playoff spot. Do you want to get this one started, Kurt, or do you want me to kick it off? Because I've got a pretty obvious place to start. I don't know about you.
I'll kick things off. I'll flip the coin in my head and it lands on myself.
Sounds good.
Rolling here. I'm going to kick it off with the thing that we're going to remember this year by the most, in my opinion. It may have not have been the most impactful thing in just directly in terms of wins and losses, even though I think it did certainly have an impact. It's the trade that David Stearns is going to possibly be remembered the most by. Now, that might be a bit of a hot take here, because the Christian Yelich trade
more than the Yelich trade.
Yeah, the Yelich trade, JR, was good. None of the players that the Marlins got back were any good, and Christian Yelich was amazing for 2 years. But I guess more so just from when general managers, presidents of baseball operation, whatever the title is, for that job, is when you make a trade that fans hate, that's the one you get remembered for more than the good one. In my opinion. So it's trading Josh Hader away. We've talked about it pretty much every podcast since they've done it, what the impact was. And I think it would be good to sort of wrap up the season with what our final opinion, at least in the 2022 version of it was. So JR, I'll pose that to you and let you pontificate a bit.
Yeah. Okay. So there's several facets to it, and we've said this. So this is sort of rounding up what we've kind of already said. But is it a full fledged disaster? It could be. I don't think it necessarily will be or has to be because of those two prospects that they got back. If those guys are key contributors, then they got something out of it. But like I've said before, those guys have to be downright superstars. If you believe this trade is the difference between making the playoffs or not, and when you're a game or two out of a playoff spot, you could make that argument, and I don't think be too far off, then losing out on a playoff season is a pretty significant loss, whether or not those guys become good players. So I think it's a lot of pressure on those two players, Esteury Ruiz and Robert Gasser. And I also think that no matter what they do, they'll always be seen as not enough in the eyes of a lot of fans, which is really tough. Again, that assumes that this trade absolutely was the thing that kept them out of the playoffs. I think you could argue either way on that, like you've said, but There's that aspect to it. Josh Hader has found himself. I mean, Josh Hader is going to be back, presumably, with the Padres next year. I mean, yes, they possibly gave up a playoff spot in 2022. They also gave up a chance to maybe trade him again, trade him in the offseason, or have Josh Hader on your team in 2023. I mean, that's still a team that could compete for the playoffs. So they gave up a lot. And you've got the Danilson Lamet aspect, the guy that they acquired in
quickly. Brewers legend.
Brewers legend Danilson Lamet, who had a very nice year, much better by WAR and some metrics in Colorado after he was claimed on waivers than guys who came over at the trade deadline, namely Taylor Rogers and Matt Bush. Those two guys are obviously part of this equation as well. If Taylor Rogers had matched or surpassed, obviously, what Josh Hader was doing, I think it would have been a much softer landing. He did not. He gave up a lot of key home runs. Yeah, I think you could argue which player was better, but ultimately it doesn't matter. If you didn't get better in the short term, then I think people are going to see that as a net loss, which, again, when it's one game out of a playoff spot or two games out, that's a big deal. Matt Bush and any of the other, Trevor Rosenthal, who never pitched for the Brewers, the other moves at the trade deadline didn't do enough to bolster the bullpen. And unquestionably, the bullpen was a weakness in the second half. And whether or not you attribute that to the Hader deal or say he was already headed in that direction, if he had been here in August, he would have been just as bad as he was in August for San Diego, and it would have been a real disaster either way. But the fact of the matter is, they made a trade ostensibly to get their bullpen more holistically rounded out to the point where it was going to be able to compete for a playoff spot. And the bullpen was the weakness in the second half. They blew, what, 16 saves since that deadline? That's a little bit of a miss. Not great, though. No, and there's a couple multiples in a game. That's a misleading stat. The saves, blown saves, you know, that could be a lot of things. But their bullpen was not a strength. And, you know, maybe they thought they were trading a little bit out of their strength to improve themselves long term, and we're taking a little bit of a step back, but whatever it is, they took a big step back, big enough, I think, that you could say costing them a chance at the playoffs. And that's it's just, whether it's optics or whether it's reality, the fact is, you point to that trade, that is the thing 2022 will be remembered for. That's the move that was made, and everything sort of pivoted from there perceptively. It was you know, going that direction beforehand, but that's a really big data point that people are always going to be thinking about.
Yeah, I'll keep it short and simple here. That trade was a gross miscalculation. I'm drawing a line in the sand here. It was gross miscalculation, I think, of the clubhouse and where their team stood. It blew up in their faces, and I think they make the playoffs without it.
Wow. All right. I don't know if I go that far. I mean, I agree with you on the clubhouse thing. I didn't even bring that up. Like, clearly, players weren't on the same page. Whether or not, you know, there's some things you can't communicate. We've talked about that on past podcasts. You can't go into your clubhouse and say, we think Josh Hader is not as good as he used to be, and we need to trade him now. You can't say that because, you know, they like him as a player. They like him as a person. That's a tough thing to sell. But however they were able to frame it or massage it, yeah, players weren't on the same page. Devin Williams... Yeah,
there's got to be a different way to handle it. I mean, the way is the front office needs to be there in Pittsburgh at the trade deadline. No one was there to talk with the players, go over it. And I think if you're going to trade away Josh Hader for a team that has World Series expectations, you have to counter it with multiple moves for guys that, you know, kind of carry some cachet, some name recognition, that are impact players. And I think the Matt Bush trade was a good trade. In the process of it, it didn't quite work out that way. But that you needed more of that, and not just in the bullpen, but around the roster. I think there was some, you know, you probably could use a starting pitcher. Like Jose Quintana would have been a great add and didn't cost all that much. And they just, I think from the offseason until through the trade deadline, it was just a sort of a miscalculation of what their team needed to make the playoffs. Now, they weren't a bad team. They won 86 games. You know, you come into the year, you think that might sneak you into the playoffs with six teams, but that's sort of the whole issue, I think, is that there was nothing above and beyond was done to try to hit a target above, not 86 games, I think they underplayed what the target was, but to hit a target of 100 games or 98 games, there, it just wasn't, the needle was not moved toward that.
Yeah, here's another aspect to it. Devin Williams is closer. Are we sure that's a role that he was interested in, that he wanted? I mean, obviously he has the ability, and I'm sure most, we assume most major league relievers want to be that guy called upon in the biggest spots. I'm speculating, I'm sure he wants that too to some degree, but he struggled in that role a little bit, and you could easily say it was just the fatigue of the season. He was never going to match what he was early in the year when he had that long scoreless inning streak and was absolutely dominating people. I mean, that's an unfair thing to sort of project over the course of the year, but it was hard for him in the closer's role. Everything was a bit of a, he labored out there quite a bit, and there were a couple games that they lost with him on the hill. There were always, there's bound to be a couple. He by and large, I think, still had a really quite a good year, and should be regarded as such, and will come back as one of their best players next year. But there's a lot of aspects to this, and I know a lot of people equate it to throwing a grenade into the clubhouse. I don't know if it was quite that dramatic, but there definitely was a different tone to this season after the Hader trade, and it coincides, I think, correlates more than causation with things like the attendance really going in the tank, the team just not being able to string wins together. They were just it just feels like it's always going to feel like the moment 2022 went south. It doesn't help that Pirates series happens right on the cusp of the trade deadline, where they lose those three games after having leads in all three, a 4-0, a 3-0, and a 3-1 lead in those games, and a lead in extras in that third game, and find a way not to win any of them in Pittsburgh against a team that wasn't really trying this year. So, that their record against the Pirates will certainly be mentioned when we talk about what went wrong for this season, for this team, Cubs and Pirates. So all of that plays into it. It's a multi-layered thing.
I'll leave with this, and then you can kick off your thoughts on what went, another thing that went wrong. But I'll leave with this. I do not think, as a front office, you want to end up with a situation in which Brent Suter having to bring a bunch of games into the clubhouse and like do all the work to try to get guys, to hang out, basically, is the situation you want in terms of having to save the morale of the clubhouse. Like, it shouldn't have to resort to that. It's great that those things happened for them, and I think they did work in terms of boosting the team chemistry and whatnot, but it shouldn't have to resort to trying to like save the season with ping pong and pop a shot in the clubhouse.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm a little agnostic on what clubhouse morale means in Major League Baseball. There have been examples of clubhouses where guys don't get along and they have a lot of success, and examples where guys really do get along and it doesn't matter. But it is noticeable, and when the team isn't winning, you interrogate all of that stuff. And here's a good example. There's just there wasn't a vibe, a positive vibe, whether in the stands, in the clubhouse, on the field, whatever it was, and the way this game was, on the way you could see them on TV, like, there just wasn't a vibe around this team. And I think a lot of that is traced to winning. I really do. I think if this team wins 95 games again, it's a little bit of a different story, but I feel like some of the building blocks were in place last year too. Things, where this team made the playoffs, but it was maybe a dubious, they don't seem to have enough offense, and that bore out in the playoffs, and that seemed to be a theme for a lot of this season as well. Just the consistency of the offense. So something it needs a jump start. It definitely does going into the off season, and you spoke about that on the last podcast. They need to spend some money. They need a big ticket item. I don't want to reduce players to sounding like merchandise, but they absolutely need somebody who's going to come in and immediately get people on their feet, get people excited, produce. I don't know if that player can just be obtained. I don't really know if that's maybe you got to wait a couple years for Jackson Churio to get here. I'm not sure. I think they maybe thought Andrew McCutchen would be that guy this year. I don't know, but there does need to be something added to this team that will take it from a middling, decent, above average winning team to back into the playoff stratosphere. Okay. So that was a lot on the Hader trade and kind of all of the tentacles, the offshoots of it. So I'll jump in then to my first thing that really comes to mind, and that's Christian Yelich. I mean, it's fair to say, and Christian Yelich spoke to you and spoke to reporters at length about the struggles he's had this season. I'm going to say right out front, I believe Christian Yelich is working his tail off, and I think he is so frustrated by what's transpired here. And I know that a lot of people may question that or doubt that, but like, Christian Yelich cares very deeply, in my suspicion and estimation, about being, you know, finding his way out of what the funk that he's gone in for the last 3 years. You know, so I don't want to make it sound like it's anything less than just, you know, the skill level, the enigma of what is lost here. It is not for lack of effort. But Christian Yelich is being paid like a superstar and is not one. And he's been, this is now 3 years, whether or not you count 2020, that's up to you. But more time with the Brewers as a guy who is below average, or below average is too harsh, but below star level, certainly, than the 2 years when he was a star, when he was an MVP caliber player. And the question is no longer about whether he'll get back to that. No one thinks he's going to. But can he get back to a point where he is the best player on this team when he's getting paid like the best player on this team? That's an important question. And I don't think the answer is yes. I don't know if you can expect after all this data, after two years and a 2020 of just being okay. He reinvented himself a little bit this year, became a leadoff hitter, you know, used his legs wherever he could, was hitting the ball a little bit better and definitely got hot in stretches. But the bottom line is this is, you know, it's about like Jace Peterson level offense and slightly better. Three win player is nothing to sneeze at. But between the fact that the guy struggles on defense, he's not an above average left fielder or anything close to it. Probably going to have to be a first baseman at some point in the future, if not just a straight up designated hitter, which limits your flexibility a little bit. The fact that he could not hit for power when he did, it was spectacular. I mean, he, you know, that 499 in Colorado was a very special moment. And he got a couple off the, you know, a couple shots off the top of the wall in the last homestand. So there's a little bit extra there, but doesn't hit for power, and that was a big part of his game. He's not he's just not the guy anymore, and the contract says he is, and you know, the Brewers can always go out and spend more money, but the fact is teams like the Brewers are going to be cautious with future contracts, knowing that maybe they got burned a little bit here with one that seemed like it was such a slam dunk, at least to me in the moment, that signing him to a long-term deal would pay dividends. I don't know if that means they're going to be gun shy about future contracts exactly, but it has to factor in. You know, you can't pay a guy, you can't go out and pay for those difference makers I'm talking about, because you've already got one contract like that on your roster, on your payroll, and it's not paying off. So that's always going to be a thing too, the decline of Christian Yelich. Everybody's still kind of scratching their head about it, but you know, I don't know if they have any other options here besides getting him at first base, getting him at DH, hope for the best, you know, and sort of kind of eat the money a little bit. You know, I don't know what else they can really do here.
Yeah, you're going to just have to find ways to compete with that contract on your roster. It's not a total wash at this juncture. I mean, like you said, he's a three-win player, and that's with, what, like 110 OPS plus? So he's just slightly above average even. But, I mean, he played a bunch of games this year, which was good. Like, the health was it's sort of a – I guess it's a dichotomy almost in a way, an oxymoron. Like, the health was good. He played – maybe he led the team in games played this year. Would have to – it's either him or Telez. And but the health is one of the reasons that he's not at the level he was. I think the back and the knee, you know, even though the knee's fixed, but the back's not totally fixed. How fixed is the knee? Is, you know, even if you think it's fixed, it definitely contributes to where he's at. But yeah, you're gonna have to live with what you can get from him, and maybe you can get a little more, but I don't think it can be used as the contract can be used as an excuse to not go in and acquire some more impact bats. And we can talk about that more. I believe, I'm pretty sure we'll talk about the offense a little more at some point here, JR, but you cannot, I think you just have to accept the fate that Christian Yelich is not going to be the elite impact bat that you need to carry the offense. Like, you just can't plan on that. If he turns out that way, great. You know, he's shown that he has the ability at previous points in his career, and if he finds it again, that's superb. But you cannot bank on that. And so I think after even going into this year, it was fair maybe to, you know, hope that the ceiling was still in there, but now after 3 years of this, you really can't do that.
Yeah, so I believe you're up now. If you have another storyline you want to pursue here,
yeah, let's just roll right into the offense. I think I was kind of touching on it there, but what an enigmatic offense! It's still wild to me that, you know, we just watched 162 games and we're not entirely sure what the offense was. It wasn't good. I don't think anyone that watched it would really tell you that it's good. And if they did, they would have a hard time justifying that and like rationalizing it. But the numbers were fine. Top 10 in runs per game, I believe. WRC plus was 11th, maybe. On the whole, you kind of figure that's going to be good enough with the way this roster is constructed. The final tally was less than the sum of all the parts, if that makes sense. You have a bunch of, average to slightly above average hitters, but it did not produce a playoff lineup.
Yeah, I think this is where I can even mention going back to the Andrew McCutchen signing, which I think was a miscalculation. He's an average league average player at most charitable, slightly below average, and they treated him like a cleanup hitter, or they gave him prominent at bats. They gave him 580 plate appearances this year. That doesn't lead the team, but it's way up there, and that's a lot of opportunities for a guy who has 700 OPS. Who's a 99 OPS plus, again, just below average. They thought he would be a difference maker. He was not. He did not pound left-handed pitching like they hoped, and he just isn't the player he used to be. So that's a huge situation. And I really feel like there's a lot of guys that are like that are fine on the surface. You don't mind those guys in your lineup. And in fact, I would say most of the guys are slightly above average hitters. Tyrone Taylor is an above average hitter by a small margin. Rowdy Tellez is, Willy Adames is, Yelich was, Colton Wong definitely was. Colton Wong had a nice year offensively. Like Hunter Renfroe absolutely was. I think Hunter Renfroe led this team in OPS plus. So those guys are all good players. They've got good players at every spot on the lineup, but they don't have anybody great. And when you're, like you said, when they're all, when you're playing all these games with good but not great players, you have good but not great offense. That's exactly what they had. And there wasn't an obvious hole is the thing. They couldn't say, well, I suppose catcher in retrospect might be the spot. Victor Caratini, do you realize, finished with a batting average of 199? Sure didn't feel like it after he came up with so many clutch hits, but catcher was below average for sure. Center field probably ended up below average between Taylor, Mitchell, Jonathan Davis, Lorenzo Cain, who really struggled coming into the year. But for the most part, there wasn't an obvious like you can upgrade here and that will make you better. It's just holistically, the concept wasn't working. I don't know if they built this team with the idea of we're going to have a star, namely Christian Yelich, and everybody else can fill in around him, and maybe that falls apart because Christian Yelich isn't the star he used to be, but they just have to just reevaluate the whole thing. I mean, you could change every spot on this lineup, and they're not going to do that. I mean, like Willy Adames is certainly going to be the shortstop next year, but they could change every spot in the lineup next year, and I think they could come up with a pretty similar offense. So it's sort of a, it's sort of a catch-22 because you can't point to anybody that's like definitely not carrying their weight, was a huge black hole or anything like that. That's not how this team was built. It's just they needed just more from everybody, in particular, like they needed superstar output from somebody, and that guy just wasn't here.
Yeah, it's funny, slightly ironic, because this by the numbers was the best offense under David Stearns.
That's wild to me. That's
Better than the
wild.
18, the 19 offenses. I don't think anyone would doubt that it was better than last year's offense. I think part of it legitimately, Jared, the run environment. You're just watching Brewers games, right? You're not watching the rest of the league all the time, with some emotional connection at least. And so you're not getting frustrated by the run environment in other games. But it was really hard to score runs in Major League Baseball this year. Let's hope that that changes. I know they want to get MLB wants more action in the game and whatnot, and that hopefully that'll help. But it was, I do think that played a part in it, because this was by the numbers a better offense than relative to the rest of the league than the ones that made the playoffs. So, I think some of the frustration, they did not miss the playoffs because of the offense. We'll say that. I just think the offense did not do enough to make up for some of the underperformances in other areas, which we still got time to get to them.
We do, and so I'll move to the pitching. The pitching was not as good as it was last year, and that's not a huge indictment. I mean, they were sensational last year. They were otherworldly. And Corbin Burnes was very good. He led the National League with 243 strikeouts. He pitched 202 innings. Much of the anti-Burnes sentiment in the Cy Young voting last year was he hadn't pitched enough. You know, going over 200 innings is quite the accomplishment. That's a heck of a thing. But he was not the same pitcher he was last year. He was good. He has a 2.94 ERA, you know, nothing to sneeze at. But this is not the dominant Corbin Burnes from last year. Brandon Woodruff maybe is pretty close to the dominant best version of Brandon Woodruff. 3.05 ERA. He didn't get, you know, he was only at 153 innings. He did have some injury stuff early in the year. You know, all his raw numbers not as good as Corbin Burnes overall. But when Woodruff came back from that battle with Raynaud's syndrome that was causing sort of numbness in his fingertips, he was just dominant. And so that's very encouraging. It feels like he got through a hurdle there and is somebody who, you know, can be relied upon. Those two guys are really good. Eric Lauer was fine. He was early on, he was sensational. We were talking like, is he going to end up in the Cy Young conversation after all this? And no, he's probably a league average pitcher when it comes down to it, but still not worse than that. He's a quality guy. And then it's question marks after that. Freddy Peralta got hurt. Still big believer in what he can do, and he flashed some pretty impressive stuff, but injuries were a big part of his story this year. He only ends up throwing 78 innings. Adrian Hauser, nowhere near the guy that he was last year. Just really really struggled all season long with health, with effectiveness. Couldn't strike guys out at the level that he previously had. So I don't even know if he comes back, to be honest, but he's a guy who struggled this year. Aaron Ashby never could find it. He was a guy who, you know, certainly showed for stretches that he was awesome and then just couldn't put guys away, you know, like ended up, you know, his whip ends up at 1.4. That's actually just slightly worse than slightly better than Adrian Hauser's. Like it was a struggle there. And then the depth of starting pitching just wasn't as good as maybe we thought it was, because, you know, you came into the year with six quality options, and then Ethan Small never developed as maybe that seventh guy. There was really nobody else. And to be fair, it's very hard to bring in somebody else in the offseason or even midseason when you've got all those options. You know, who's going to want to pitch for the Milwaukee Brewers in the rotation if they're option number 8 or 9 or whatever? But those guys did not materialize for whatever reason. It didn't happen that they were able to offset those losses. And then then obviously there's the bullpen, which had, you know, we've already sort of alluded to the struggles that they had holding leads. You know, they had guys like Trevor Gott, who was good for times and not good in other times. And Brad Boxberger is sort of in that boat. And Brent Suter, I think, has sort of slid back a little bit from 2019 era Brent Suter when he was so good. Similar to the offense, there's a lot of relievers who are fine, and it's just when you sort of like look at them in total, it just didn't end up working out. Jason Alexander got a lot of innings this year. He's a great story, but you know, he isn't a guy that you want to rely on in a big league rotation. Just you know, just sort of a thing that did not come together, and hard to really say, well, it was this guy or that guy. It just didn't come together as a unit.
Yeah, I think I do think the bullpen is the biggest reason maybe on this team they missed the playoffs relative to expectations. Now, the starting pitching was not elite as expected, but kind of as you talked to there, Brandon Woodruff and Corbin Burnes. Corbin Burnes over the entire year, and then Brandon Woodruff for the final 3+ months of the year, I mean, were excellent. You maybe didn't get the elite performances from both them all year, but they were fantastic and definitely good enough to lead a playoff rotation. But yeah, you just lost so many games that you should not have lost at the end, because I mean, part of it was the offense, and I think they in a lot of those games situationally they did not score enough, tack on enough runs. But at the end of the day, sure, a bullpen is going to lose some games, blow some leads, but it was so frequent, especially over the second half of the year after trading Hader. I mean, honestly, like starting in July, once Hader kind of was experiencing a blip on the radar while still with the Brewers, there was just so many leads, so many chances that went by the wayside. And I know they still had a winning record in one-run games, but they started off really hot in that category, and kind of regression hit them and hurt them. So, yeah, it was a tough year for the bullpen that, it doesn't exactly work out this way. You know, you pick two or three wins that you win, and then all of a sudden you make the playoffs, because every team blows games. But it just seems like the Brewers did have, and they did, like you mentioned, the blown stat lead. They did have more opportunities that they let slip by the wayside, especially in the games that quote unquote matter the most at the end.
You know, I look at these stats. I feel like I'm being unfair to Corbin Burns. To even, I mean, 2.94 ERA in 202 innings. He's still striking out more than 10, almost 11 guys a game. His WHIP is below one. Really good. I don't want to sell him short.
Yeah,
it's a really good season.
He speaking of Cy Young voting, let's just say he merited consideration on a ballot that I know of.
Yeah. Yes. We talked about how you will have a vote in the Cy Young, so we have to be careful what we say there. But you know, he's not going to win the Cy Young. I think we all know that. But still, he after coming off of the Cy Young season, he definitely he wasn't quite at that elite level. But that elite level was just bananas. So it's an unfair standard. And Josh Hader, I think his stats belie how good he was when he was here. You know, the first 2 months of the season, remember, he hadn't given up a run. He didn't give up a run until June. And in fact, the first game he gave up runs back-to-back, or it wasn't back-to-back, but there was a batter in between, two homers in the ninth inning against the Phillies, and blew a save and lost the lead, and the Brewers lost that game 3-2. If they win that game, they tie the season series. The Brewers will, of course, have one more win on their ledger. They'll be tied with the Phillies in the final standings and would get into the playoffs on tiebreaker because of the intra-division record being next on the list. The Brewers would have gotten that by a game. It would have been by the thinnest of margins gotten in if they could have locked that game down. So that's just one. I mean, whatever. There's a million different sliding doors over the course of a season, but that's just one that jumped out at me. Josh Hader with a 4.24 ERA when it's all said and done during his time in Milwaukee, you know, 1-4 record, but 29 saves. Like, people aren't going to look at this and think, oh, he had a really great year. But for a while there, he was same old unstoppable Josh Hader. It's just things started to go wrong in June and continued to kind of struggle throughout throughout the rest of the summer. And then he gets traded in August and continues to struggle before rebounding a little bit. Two very different seasons for Josh Hader. The start and the last month with San Diego and then the things in between. Also a little bit of an enigma. All right, what's your third thing for our wrap up here?
I think there's a lot of ways I could go with this last one. I think we could point to, you know, maybe trying to look forward to what in 10 years will have been the biggest stories when we look back in retrospect, and maybe one of them is there seemed to be for the first time like a disconnect or a rift a little bit between ownership and in the front office. Maybe I think you point to some of those quotes from the trade deadline. It seemed like not everyone was on the same page, but I don't think that. So I think there is also some just generally some bad luck that this team suffered. You need luck to, you know, you definitely need luck to win a World Series in the playoffs, but sometimes you need luck to make it to the playoffs, and they just didn't seem to ever quite have that. But no, I think I'm just going to point to just in general. I mean, it was a failed season, right? Like, it was a disappointment. When your expectations are not only to win the division, but in the worst division in baseball, that is, considering the bottom three teams in there, but to win the World Series or make the World Series or to go on a deep playoff run, and you can't even, you know, get through the NL Central as a wild card, it's got to be viewed as a failed season. Luckily, they'll have a chance to bounce back next year. Not all is lost. The core pretty much all returns, even though there should be some new faces elsewhere. But yeah, it was just a season that went by the wayside, a missed opportunity, a year of Corbin Burns and Brandon Woodruff and Willy Adames and Devin Williams that there was not enough else there to supplement it, that it wound up with the team going to play golf on October 6th.
Yeah, expectations are not a team's problem, but they had to think that they were a playoff team coming into the year. If not and they were in many eyes the outright favorite to win the National League Central Division. And why not? They had won it last year, 95 games. They brought everybody back. Their record in one-run games, you mentioned, it's similar to last year. You know, it wasn't like they got crazy lucky last year. They had a Cy Young. They had a Cy Young winner. They had a lot of room to grow on offense because I think we still were in a space where we thought Christian Yelich could figure it out, could get back to who he was. They had new hitting coaches, maybe help sort of, you know, sort of catalyze that process. And nothing like that materialized, and so expectations may not be their fault, but like we've said before, this is if not the most disappointing season in Brewers history, it's on the list. You know, maybe you go back to 1983 when they came back off of a World Series runner-up finish, bringing back a lot of the same guys, but that was a different era where you didn't have six teams from each league making the postseason as you do this year. And you know, Craig Counsell made this comment that teams with their level of win totals have won World Series before, that they easily could have been a playoff team and easily made a run to the World Series. That's true. I would also point out that with the extra round of the playoffs this year, it's less true than it was before because there's one more hurdle you have to clear. You know, if it's all random, one more coin flip you got to win essentially. And then on top of that, there are only two teams that have won the World Series with this number of wins. One of them was the 2006 Cardinals team that, you know, was really good most of the year, got really cold in September. And then a guy who's got the same pitching numbers as Adrian Hauser, we know his name, it's Jeff Suppan, ends up going on an absolute crazy run through the postseason.
That was a dagger right there.
That's low. That was low. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Brewers fans. But I mean, I always hate it when it's like, well, you have to butt this and butt that. You know, like, find a caveat for each of this stuff. But you know, we're only talking about two teams. I think it was the 87 Twins and the 2006 Cardinals. And quite honestly, I don't think this team could have gone deep into the playoffs. And I don't know anybody who really does. Nobody thought this team was going to get into the playoffs, get hot, and get on a roll. The only thing you could say is they do have two elite starting pitchers. And that sometimes can be a difference-making situation in the postseason. But this team just didn't have a consistency level. It didn't inspire the idea that they could actually go out and win, you know, six of seven games in October. No one thought that. So
yeah, the hot streaks were not there ever.
So yeah, right. So this is it may not be the most disappointing season ever. I don't know. That's really hard to gauge, but it's on the list.
I think it is. I think so. It's hard to say in the moment. I mean, but it sure felt like it, just the inability to ever get over the hump, so to speak. So, yeah. And I wonder, and David Stearns will not admit to this probably on Tuesday. No one in the organization would, but at least not publicly. But, you know, maybe there's some benefit to missing the playoffs as opposed to sneaking in with 87 wins and then, you know, getting beat in two games in St. Louis. Not saying that would have happened. They could have gone on a run. Who knows? But just being able to say you made the playoffs, I don't know if, you know, maybe missing the playoffs makes for a little more change. You know, just from a standpoint of, okay, we have to really investigate our process and see if we need to mix things up. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I don't really buy that. You can investigate your process and mix things up even if you do make the playoffs. I think they should have, looking after last season, how things went south in the postseason. If it's just an intrinsic internal reevaluation, yeah, you can do that anyway.
I think that's where the thought comes from though, is because what we've seen over the last, really since the end of the 2019 season, it's been a bunch of standing pat in the offseason and not making many big changes. This is the different outcome now. You're probably right, but maybe the results of the winter are different because of missing the playoffs. Who knows?
Yeah. You know, I think what you're saying is maybe sort of shocking ownership into realizing they need to spend more money. That's probably what we're going for. I'm going to throw one last thing that's a little more charitable as my final for our sort of prolonged three up, three down here. And that's the St. Louis Cardinals, man. They way overperformed. You know, they won 93 games this year. I don't think anybody, you know, even in the most optimistic of scenarios, thinks the Brewers team could have won 93 games, could have actually contended for that NL Central. That became a big problem for them. They definitely, you know, you got to give credit to the Cardinals. You know, they got great contributions. Albert Pujols had a renaissance season, deeply upsetting for Brewers fans. They got the NL MVP on their team in Paul Goldschmidt. You know, Tommy Edman and Brendan Donovan had great years this year. Ryan Helsley became one of the best closers, if not arguably, I don't know about Edwin Diaz, but the best closer in baseball. I don't know, but like everybody, it's like the Brewers where they kind of have a guy everywhere, except all of their guys are maybe overperforming a little bit. Like Lars Nootbaar and Dylan Carlson and Adam Wainwright continues to be a problem. The franchise continues to rally around Yadier Molina. You know, he might not be a stud offensively anymore, but he's still a guy people love, and their bullpen was very good. I mean, the Cardinals overperformed, and that made things more difficult. Now, the Brewers should have still been a playoff team, should have still been a wild card team, because they, again, as we mentioned before, couldn't beat up on teams like the Pirates and the Cubs, and that was a problem. They did beat up on the Reds, and they held their own against the Cardinals. It was a one-game spread. Cardinals won that season series by a game. So, like, that's what you expect if you've got two really good teams in the division. That's totally a fine outcome, but you got to beat up on the Pirates and Cubs. They did do that. The Brewers did last year. They really made hay against their division. And if anything, you could look at that and say, well, they maybe probably shouldn't have been a 95 win team last year. Maybe they were a little bit, maybe they overachieved a little bit. And so the underachieving that we perceive in 2022 isn't maybe quite as dramatic as maybe it could be. I don't know about that. I go back and look at that 2021 team, and I feel like 95 was probably about right for them. But, you know, that's also something to point out. I don't think they were ever going to catch these St. Louis Cardinals. So frustrating as that is, I do think that's part of the picture as well.
Yeah, no, the Cardinals just played really, really well. And it felt like it's almost surprising that they only won 93 games, considering how many guys outperformed what you would have expected coming in the year. Like, no one expected Lars Nootbaar to be a three-win player, to be one of the best hitters in the league in the second half. You probably have the one and two finishers in the MVP race. So, you know, the possible reliever of the year. So it's a bit of a surprise that they only, quote unquote, only won 93 games.
It is. It would be nice if Nolan Arenado just opted out and went somewhere else. We know he's not going to, but it would be nice. He's sensational, and like I said, the biggest move the Brewers could make is go back in time and offer more than the Rockies or than the Cardinals did to the Rockies, so that they could have that third baseman. That would change some things pretty dramatically. Looking ahead, Kurt, 2023, there are some mysteries on this team. The biggest one is kind of where the younger wave of players fit on this team. They've got a lot of guys in AAA who are going to be part of the equation, whether or not they're traded in the offseason, or, you know, whether or not they actually do start on the big league team, kind of case by case, I don't know. None of these guys are, I shouldn't say none, but it's not like these guys are expected to be the stars of the team next year. But you've got, you have Garrett Mitchell, who we saw here in the final month of the season. That's a guy who can play center field, which I think is an interesting position battle between him, Tyrone Taylor, maybe Esturi Ruiz or Sal Frelick get in there. Ruiz and Frelick are two guys who've been performing well, and Frelick in particular has really mashed this year at AAA. He's the guy you got to have on next year's team. Joey Weimer is a possibility in the outfield as well. So they have a lot of outfielders, which is one of the reasons why I think Yelich could end up at first base or DH, and whether or not they trade Hunter Renfroe, which I think you and I agree is not a necessary move that they have to make, but is a possibility given the number of outfielders they have. You've got Bryce Terang, who's going to come in on the infield somewhere. Mario Feliciano is probably going to have to be one of your two catchers next year. Maybe Robert Gasser makes the pitching staff as well, but there are a lot of guys, and I'd be curious to know which ones you think are going to have the biggest impact at all next year. But, and will any of them you think be in the starting lineup on opening day?
Ooh, that's a good question. Biggest impact? I think at least one of those outfielders or prospects will get traded by opening day. That's my take on it. I think that's where your depth is, and you need to acquire something, some sort of impact player somewhere. So who knows who that ends up being. I do think Sal Frelick has the best chance of being the best out of that group. Even though it's funny, Garrett Mitchell led the team in WRC plus and OPS this year. Like,
that's wild.
It was boosted by a 500 BABIP despite his really high strikeout rate. But like that it's sort of, he proved he's got like a floor as a big leaguer, especially if you can cut down the strikeouts. So that was positive. As if any of them start the season with the team, I'm going to say yes. Start opening day, I'm going to say no. I don't think they should hitch their wagons to one of those guys being like a three-win player, but I definitely think they should give them a chance to do it and see if any of them work out. And like I said, I think Sal Frelick's got the best chance of sticking. I don't know if they're committed to starting him on opening day. They should definitely take a serious look at it. He seemed like he was shouting out. Teams always like to say they like to promote players when they, you know, players tell them they need to get promoted. Well, Sal Frelick was shouting it. He's too good for AAA. So Garrett Mitchell's probably too good for AAA. Esturi Ruiz also probably too good for AAA. So it's It's almost it's a point it's a it's it's a part of it though, like you cannot have all of them just simply from a roster construction standpoint, unless your entire outfield is Yelich and the young guys and Taylor. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I do end up thinking, I mean, I think Mitchell will be your opening day center fielder, but I don't know. I could be convinced any number of ways how center field goes. I do think Bryce Terang ends up, if maybe not starting on opening day, but he's going to be on the opening day roster. I'm curious what the infield. Colton Wong isn't going to be here most likely, so Luis Urias, I would guess, is your second baseman. So now third base is a really interesting opening. I don't know if they want Bryce Terang to be that guy. He's more, I think, being groomed as a utility option at this point. I don't know if they go get a third baseman. Those guys are just not available on the open market. That might be a trade situation. Maybe that's where you use a trade piece like a Renfroe or a Keston Hiro. I'll talk about here in a second, but like. There's some question marks there. So I think they are going to get big contributions from the young kids next year. The bigger question, which we're not ready to answer yet, is when Jackson Churio gets here. Second half of next season still seems awfully optimistic, but if he is doing what he's doing at Double A and Triple A, which is a huge if, huge, that he was doing other levels this year, I think Jackson Chourio has to be on this team at some point next year, and it will be very exciting when he does. So I alluded to Keston Hiro. I have no idea what happens with him next year. If Yelich is your DH, I don't know where he plays, and I don't know what they do with him. They experimented with him in left field a little bit. He got some action at second base and first base. I don't know if any of those options are ideal. He and Hunter Renfroe is the other one. Hunter Renfroe is a quality player, and if you have other guys around him, you could do so much worse than having Hunter Renfroe as your 5-6 hitter, something along those lines. But he might be one of the more tradable options. This would be his last year that the Brewers would have him under control in 2023. So I would have to imagine they at least explore moving him, knowing that they have these younger outfielders available to them. So those are two guys that I really don't know. If somebody were like, will Hunter Renfroe and Keston Hiro be on this team next year? I truly, truly don't know. What do you think?
I guess I don't know either, but they are two, like the more, like you said, more tradable assets. I do think in the end Hunter Renfroe will be back, but the guys just don't get to see like the end of arbitration, arbitration through with the Brewers. It's not something that happens. So do they want to pay him 10, 11 million? We'll see. I think the thing is we learned with Hira is that the Brewers should not just commit to it's like a single DH bringing someone in at, I think their best option is just throw guys at that spot that you have on the roster, whether that's Yelich, Hira, Telez, and then kind of just let the position player group figure itself out after that.
So another thing, extensions for these two pitchers, Brandon Woodruff, Corbin Burns. It doesn't sound like there's been a ton of dialogue on that front. I really am curious to know how that goes, because ultimately I think it's easy to see a scenario where one of the two guys gets signed, probably more likely Woodruff than Burns, and then the other is walks into free agency. I also think that if you want to be a team that competes for World Series, not just even goes to the playoffs, but if you want to be a World Series contender, you got to have two stud pitchers. That's a bare minimum. The teams that are in the playoffs right now, they've got two guys almost to a team. There's a couple maybe nots. I don't know, like San Diego, I'm not sure, but like there, if you want to be a World Series contender, you've got two stud pitchers. You probably have way more than that, but you got at least that. The Brewers, if they want to keep up with the Joneses, have got to have that, and they've got those two guys right now. They could go back to the playoffs next year and be a World Series contender. That's on the table because of those two guys. So and they should be back next year regardless, but extensions, don't you have to find a way to make that happen? And we talked about the Yelich extension. Pitchers are historically even more tenuous than position players. So, Burns did, at least in the home run category, backslide a little bit this year. So, you're looking forward. It's like, well, do you want to sign a guy as he gets into his 30s? All that stuff is stuff you have to consider. But I just don't think this team can call itself a World Series contender anymore if it lets those two guys walk. There's nobody coming in behind them in the minor league system who is going to be at that level, at least not yet. So what do you think happens here with those two guys in terms of long-term deals?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's different avenues to winning, and they don't have to have Corbin Burns and Brandon Woodruff to, eventually morph into a different version of a World Series contender. Like we saw in 2018, they're a totally different type of team, and I think I think the front office is smart enough to be able to win in different ways, but this, I mean, having those two guys is realistically like their best shot that they're probably going to have. And so it's my understanding, though, that neither of, I mean, Corbin Burns said this all publicly as well, but it's my understanding that neither of them have had those talks yet with the front office about extensions. Now, part of that, I think, is like the nuance of it is there was a there's lockout season and guys don't really like doing those conversations during the season a lot of the time. But yeah, you've got to try. You have to try, whether it's them or Willie or someone. It just does not exude a good optics or a good vibe, you know, if that you say you want to contend for World Series, but then you let both those guys or all three of those guys walk. Now, there's probably not room to sign all three, but there's certainly room to sign one and possibly at least two, and then also still bring in some more short-term help for next year.
Yeah, I shouldn't just overlook the possibility that Freddie Peralta is at that level too. I mean, obviously this was a little bit of a star-crossed year for him with the injuries, but he could be at that level too. So Brewers could go into, you know, a situation where they have one of the two and Freddie and argue they still have two elite guys, or Lauer or Ashby, you know, could certainly get better. And I think I think the Brewers are dreaming on that happening. So that could be the case too. I just, man, it's just hard to picture them not pursuing both guys at this point. Any other last thoughts, Craig? Craig, you're not Craig, you're Kurt.
Oh my goodness. Craig
and David Stearns, presumably Mark Attanasio, we think are going to be meeting the media on Tuesday. So there could be some additional revelations that we touch on. I imagine we'll have another podcast episode at some point after that. But any last thoughts before that, with what before we sort of sneak into the off season?
Well, you call me Craig. Fangraphs calls me Carl. It's just no. I think. I think we tried to touch on just about everything with this team. I do think that 2023, the Brewers are still in good shape. It was an underwhelming year this year, but pretty much all the impact guys are back next year, and maybe there's a fire. There's a little bit of a fire to do something more in the offseason, and you know, maybe the players show up to spring training with some fire to do more. So I still have optimism. Looking forward about the 2023 season, although getting back to World Series contender will require some work.
Yeah, and as we head into the postseason, I realize that most Brewers fans are probably not interested in a shred of Major League Baseball postseason, but a lot of Wisconsin guys in the mix: Jared Kelenic for the Mariners, Gavin Lux for the Dodgers, Owen Miller from Ozaukee is playing for the Guardians, and man, I'm missing one. Already drawing a blank on the various counties. Oh, Danny Jansen from Appleton playing for the Toronto Blue Jays. So that's a pretty cool thing. And I'll close it down here with my interview that I did with another guy who isn't going to the playoffs this year, but certainly could in the future. The Diamondbacks are an interesting team going forward. Arizona, they were again here to close the season. And I caught up with Dalton Varsho. He's from Marshfield. He is the son of a former major leaguer who is also from Marshfield. And Gary Varsho, he also went to UW-Milwaukee. He's the only UW-Milwaukee alumnus to reach the major leagues, and has a very interesting story in that he's a catcher by trade. He came up as a catcher, sort of became the a catcher center field hybrid. I mean, he plays right field too a lot, but outfield catcher hybrid, and he ended up becoming one of the more impressive defensive outfielders in baseball. There is an absolute argument that he is the best defensive outfielder in baseball in 2022. The Gold Gloves are a ways off, but I definitely expect to hear Dalton Varsho's name mentioned for probably right field more than center field, although center is where his numbers are really, really good, so I'm not actually sure of that, but wanted to catch up with him. Got a chance to meet with him before the start of the Brewers series. So a tiny little postscript here, Kurt. We will again touch base again soon. And thanks for joining me, man. Talk to you soon.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Here's my conversation with Varsho. Thanks for tuning into Microbrew. We'll be back with you very soon. Bye bye. My guest is Dalton Varsho. He is a catcher slash outfielder. Probably outfielder now is the better way to put it, for the Arizona Diamondbacks. He is a native of Marshfield, Wisconsin, UW-Milwaukee, the only UW-Milwaukee player to ever make it to the big leagues. I have to double check every time I say that because it feels like there should be more UW-Milwaukee guys who've made it to the big leagues. Do you feel that way too? There's not any names that I'm missing that you know of, is there?
No. There's guys who are really close. Trevor Schwecke and yep. Brian Keller. They're pretty close. I hope they get a chance.
Yeah, so for people who do not know your background, you grew up in Marshfield. Your dad, Gary Varsho, was the
Rattlers manager, played for played in the big leagues, around big leagues a long time. So did you spend all your time in Marshfield, or was there a time where you were with your dad traveling? Like how just give me your whole upbringing, I guess.
Yeah, so for the first part of my life, my dad was with the Phillies organization. He was the Double A manager from when I could actually like remember some things. And then he got to the big leagues as a bench coach under Larry Bowe and Charlie Manuel. So my childhood was kind of weird. I would start school at home in September, and then when spring training came around, I would fly to Florida, go to school down there for 2 months, and then fly back home, finish school, and then in the summertime, go out and see my dad in Philly.
Okay.
So, like, it was kind of a different kind of upbringing a little bit, but it was pretty cool to be able to do that and be around the guys in the clubhouse and just be around my dad at that point.
And what's it like being the child of a Major League Baseball player, Marshall? I mean, your dad went to Marshfield too, so everyone knows who he is, and now you have to, I guess, follow in his footsteps. Is that a comfortable experience? A lot of moving around, I guess.
No, just because, like, he didn't really put much pressure on me to play baseball since I've been growing up. And
that's great.
Just kind of let me be who I was, and it was kind of nice that I had two older sisters that I could kind of follow a little bit too, with Andy and Taylor, and they were kind of sports people, and both my sisters being able, one went to go to softball, play Purdue, and the other one went to go play basketball at Colorado State and then transferred to Sioux Falls.
Yeah, so I know that you were a catcher for a while. I don't know exactly when you started the outfield thing, if that was at UWM or if that was in the minor league. So when did outfield enter the picture for you?
I would say a little bit in college, more in the Northwoods League when I was playing in Eau Claire.
Sure.
But in professional baseball, I didn't start playing outfield until 2019 in Jackson and Double A.
Okay. And I mean, if I look at the metrics, there's a case that you're the best defensive outfielder in the major leagues. Like, I don't know how that resonates with you, or if you, I mean, it's got to be incredible. It's incredible that anybody who comes up as a catcher is capable of that. What do you just attribute your success to? Like, how are you able to make that transition and make it to the point that you are an elite defensive outfielder?
Yeah, I take kind of pride in being a great defensive player. And it's just pretty cool that kind of just my skills have kind of parlayed more into being an outfield just defensively. But being able to take a lot of reads out in the outfield for BP is kind of what I've done to try to get really good at it. There's a guy, Evan Marzilli, he used to be with us in Jackson, and he kind of taught me a little bit of some drills that I could do to make my routes a little bit better, and being able to read balls off the bat a lot more clean. So I give him a little bit of some credit to be able to help me out as kind of both being minor league players and both trying to get to the big leagues. He took the time and energy to be able to make me a better player out there. So being able to go through that, and with Dave McKay here, my dad having some resources to help me out of footwork positioning and understanding what I needed to do to get better at what I'm trying to do, either whether it was in center and right field.
There's a chance you'll get a Gold Glove here. That has to mean a lot, right? To be in that position where you could get something like that.
Yeah, Gold Glove means a lot to me. I would really, really like to get one eventually in my career, and if it's this year, it'd be great. If it's in the years to come, it is what it is. But all I can do is to be prepared and play the position hard like I can.
I'm sure that everybody brings it up. Well, there aren't any catchers who play outfield and do it well. I don't know, Charlie Moore from the 1982 Brewers back, you know, ages ago was somebody who kind of did that. But is there anyone you've modeled your career after? Is that possible, that somebody who could sort of speak to the talents of both? Or have you just constantly had to just learn the two skills separately?
Yeah, I kind of had to learn the two skills separately, of being able to take some things that I've learned from other players and kind of mold it into what I can do. So when I was kind of doing both early on in the year, of catching a little bit more and doing a little outfield, it was kind of being able to control my workload and understanding what my body can take. And now being a full-time outfielder, it's kind of a little bit different of the things I can do. I can do a little bit more while just being able to prepare every game.
So when you're born, I believe it's when you're born, your dad is at that point manager of the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers. You get to any Timber Rattlers games? You have any connection still? I know that's, you know, that's not your organization, but still there's got to be a little bit of a connection, right?
Yeah, my dad used to go there because he scouted for the past 9 years, so he still had those connections through there. And
nice.
He actually still had more connections going into Reading than he did in Appleton, so
cool.
It was pretty cool to kind of him to kind of circulate back. And I never got to play over in Reading, but it was pretty cool to kind of see those connections of how they kind of parlay out through your life. But I just remember being in the clubhouse with some great Phillies in that time, with Jim Thome, Jimmy Rollins, Shane Victorino, Kenny Lofton. Like, there were so, and Chase Utley. I mean, there were so awesome. Many great Phillies at that point. And it was just cool to be around those guys and learn a little bit and try to take it all in and just kind of understand of how cool of a lifestyle it is and see how special it is of getting to be that young and being able to be be around that great of minded guys in this game.
Those guys beat the Brewers in 2008. Are you here for that? Were you around for those games?
I was not here for those
games. Got it. All right. So because your dad went to Oshkosh, you chose UW-Milwaukee. Was there any intentionality there to just doing something different than him, or is that a completely independent? I imagine that was probably a completely independent choice, right?
Yeah. I love football, so those are kind of my two main sports, but I knew that with my size I wasn't going to be able to pursue really much after high school with football because, those boys are a little bit bigger when I get to college.
A little taller, that's all right. What are you going to do?
But no, I did love baseball. My dad didn't push any position on me or anything, and so it was kind of cool that I kind of chose it myself. And I chose UW-Milwaukee just because of the fact of I like Scotty Duffick. I liked what he kind of told me about me coming in as a catcher, because a lot of other colleges didn't want me to catch. They thought I was too small, just didn't have an arm for it. So he kind of took a, not really a chance, but he trusted me to be the player that he thought I could be. And I'm grateful for him to be able to accept me as one of his players, and I really appreciate it.
You're a Packers guy, right? So you're pretty happy about the 3-1 start, I take it?
Yeah, that win yesterday was a little nervous.
Yeah.
I called my buddy after the game because I was on West Coast time, so I didn't see most of it. And I was like, dude, what happened? And he goes, dude, they got lucky a little bit. But I'm happy that the Packers are doing well. I love their defense. I love everything about the Packers.
Yeah. So last one, there's a bunch of Wisconsin guys now. I don't know if you keep in touch with guys like Gavin Lux or Jared Kelenic or any of the other Wisconsin guys that are coming up in the pipeline. Do you have a chance to communicate with them? Do you have like a fraternity?
Yeah. So with Gavin, I mean, we saw him
all the time.
So many times this year. I was so glad that he's had a great year. I mean, he's put up some really good numbers for the Dodgers and trying to make himself an everyday guy over there with really good players.
Yeah.
I really keep in touch with Taron Vavra a little bit. He made his big league debut this year.
He was at a hot start too for Baltimore. He was kicking butt.
He was doing really well. And then JP FireEyes, and I work out with him in the offseason a little bit. So just kind of texting them guys every once in a while and just checking in and see how they're doing.
All right, man. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.